No, yeah, I just didn't know if you had anything else on RCS editing.
No.
You can tell we're so scatterbrained.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, all right, sorry. I'm scatterbrained. It's big Friday energy.
Hello and welcome to the Android Police Podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Google released a new Android feature drop. This is a big one. We'll talk about why and what it means for you as an Android user, whether you're on a Pixel phone or otherwise. And then Google's also saying that it's going to fix a bunch of its AI overview problems, so you won't be eating glue and or rocks in the near future. Hopefully, there was a state of play yesterday that I think Will is excited to talk about. The remake of Silent Hill 2 is definitely up there with one of your favorite games of all time, I know. I'm just joking. I'm terrified of horror games, so I don't actually think it's not on my list. Are you a horror movie person?
I've never actually played the Silent Hill games. Silent Hill 2 seems like something I would enjoy. The remake looks bad, I would say, from everything I know about Silent Hill 2. No, I've never gotten super deep into horror games, I guess. I'm more into horror movies than games. I feel like the game side freaks, it's a little too intense sometimes. Freaks it also, truly, every Halloween I'm like, this is the year I'm gonna play a bunch of horror games, and then like October 31st comes around, like November 1st rolls, and I'm like, ah, maybe next year. It's not happening.
I'm still recovering from System Shock 2. Like, to this day, I have not gotten over my terror when playing that, and it's like 25 years old. Okay, so let's just go over.
I should say, hey, I'm here. I feel like I didn't get an intro, but hey, hi.
Oh, sorry. It's like you it's and fine. I have been talking.
We've been talking for an hour.
This, so I'm like, I just forgot to introduce you. That's Will Saddleberg. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Sorry, I'm selfish. I just
No. It's honestly, it was pretty funny.
Yeah. So Google has had a rough week. It told people to eat glue and rocks in its AI overviews. Yeah. Google then released a statement yesterday on its official blog, basically blaming users, not itself, which I love it when companies do that. Liz Reed, the VP of search, basically said that AI overviews don't hallucinate, and that its sources, when it doesn't have a lot of really high quality results, it just pulls from what it has. So the reason that people have been asking how many rocks should you eat, like that's not a question that a lot of people ask Google very often. So why would it have a good answer for that? Which I can kind of see from Google's perspective. It's like, you're just trying to break this thing that we built, and then you broke it and you're blaming us for not having a solution. I'm like, well, fair, but isn't like the whole point of having an LLM to like set up roadblocks so that you don't tell people to eat glue and rocks in the first place?
I would feel much more inclined to buy what Google is saying here if they weren't Google, right? Like if they were like some small startup and a bunch of trolls, for lack of a better word, like swarmed this new search bot that a startup made and like got it to say a bunch of dumb shit, I'd be like, yeah, that sucks. Like, of course you were going to break it if you fed it a bunch of dumb shit, but like, you're Google and you're calling this the future of search. It should be able to combine the power of an LLM with the knowledge of your search engine and the ability for you to pull up any amount of information and like get things right. And so like, first, this blog post that they put out is like, AI overviews don't hallucinate, and then goes on to say like, it just does other things that like, we're just not calling hallucinations, right? So like, I don't buy that. But also like, AI overview can tell me if I Google how many rocks should I eat, it should be able to be like none. Like, why is it sourcing a Reddit joke? It should be like, you shouldn't eat rocks. That's all it should say. Zero. You should eat zero rocks. It doesn't even need to elaborate further. All of this stuff where it's like, oh, well, you broke it by being like, how much glue should I put into my pizza sauce? Okay, like, if your LLM is so intelligent, if your new AI-powered search tool is so good, it should be able to identify that this is a nonsense question and either not generate, which is another option because AI overviews are incredibly inconsistent as to when they do and don't spawn. But also, it should be like, don't put glue in pizza sauce. Period.
Yes, like, you're absolutely right. Google is a big company. They've been testing. This is not new, right? SGE is not a brand new product.
No, they've been doing this for 18 months.
Because it rolled out.
Publicly, 18 months.
It was being tested by not an insignificant number of Americans. It was in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people for, what, a year? 18 months?
Yeah, Google gave me a one-on-one demo and then access to SGE in, like, February or March of 2023. So, like, it has been around for a long time at this point, I would say.
Right. So that's, I think, not an excuse.
Right.
The fact that nobody has specifically searched for and then publicized how many rocks should I eat in that time period does not negate the fact that Google must have enough data to know that replace rocks with anything that is not food. How much poison should I eat? How many pieces of glass should I eat? Right? Like, you don't have to individually scrutinize every single one of these search terms to know that you can just put a filter against some of this stuff. And again, I'm not saying that people didn't try to manipulate AI overviews. Obviously, they did. But a lot of companies, when they release a product, they're like, break it. Please, try to break it. We love you for breaking this. Like, that's why they call it a beta test in a lot of cases. I mean, gaming, like, developers and publishers are leaning more into that than ever, right? Hades 2 was released in early access because Hades 1 was basically built in front of an audience and ended up better for it. Baldur's Gate 3 in early access for like 3 years. I mean, I remember when Baldur's Gate 3 was a Stadia exclusive in 2019.
Well, and the part that everyone agrees on in that game that is the strongest is Act 1, which is the part that was tested in front of an audience for, you know, 3 years.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of the output that is weird that is coming from AI overviews is just sourced from Reddit to begin with. Like, Google made this big deal with Reddit, right? They've caught on that everyone is just using Google to search Reddit. And so they're like, we'll do it, guys. Don't worry. We'll just make Reddit the top 18 results on every search. And then AI overview will just pull directly from Reddit. And like, in this blog post, they point out that, like, oh, AI overviews featured sarcastic or trolly content from discussion forums. Have you not browsed Reddit? Like, did you not know what you were feeding into Gemini? Like, how did you not think this would happen? Like, of course, like, a lot of shit post comments were going to come out of this. And again, it just comes off as Google being like, wow, how could you guys feed poor information into our poor LLM? Don't you know how hard we worked on this?
Yeah, I think the defensive tone of this blog post makes me uncomfortable because she's basically saying not only were people trying to break the thing that we built and use it in a way that we didn't intend, but people also then manipulated the results to make it look worse for Google. Like, poor Google. And I don't think they would have done that if the actual results didn't tell people to eat glue. To me, that's just not a legitimate defense.
Yeah, the idea that Google is mad that people were faking screenshots, it gets its own paragraph in this blog post about faked screenshots on Twitter or other social media places, right? Like, that only happens because the real examples AI overviews were giving people were so ridiculous that it becomes a meme that you can then fake. Like, no one, certainly not like normal users, like, but even in like the tech specific community, like, no one was like, I know, I'll just like fake a bunch of AI overview results for like clout on Twitter, because normal people would not have like even known what the joke you were making was if you did that. The fake screenshots came because you were already a meme. Your bad results were already being dunked on, and people said, I can make these even funnier by doing outlandish social media posts.
The thing that really gets to me, though, above anything else, is like, if you go to the bottom of that blog post, one of the related stories is the original announcement from Google I/O,
yeah,
which is generative AI in search, let Google do the searching for you. It's written by the same person, Liz Reed, the VP and head of search. And the reason this gets me is that We've been trained for 20 years now to do the work. Like, Google obviously ranks things, and we'll talk about that in a second, but we do the work of figuring out the sources that we want to click on, right? And over the years, Google has, with cookies and a bunch of other data about us, they have catered the search results to us to some extent, right? So where I live and the other things that Google has a profile about me influence the results of the search. But in general, if I search, like, you know, how to get wine out of a carpet, or how to get a wine stain out of a carpet, like, I will be able to find something reliable that I can click on. And if I don't like that thing, I can continue searching until I find something that I like. And the incentive structure, I'm not saying that Google has removed the 10 blue links, but Google is telling us that that incentive structure has been, if not removed entirely, then undermined by its own AI overviews, and that you should be able to trust the single thing that Google tells you to do when you search how to get a wine stain out of the carpet, right? So you're saying, let Google do the searching for you. And then when it gets it wrong, it's then blaming us. And I don't like that. That relationship that you have with the internet, because Google is the internet for all intents and purposes, is changing in front of our eyes. And we talked about this last week, not necessarily for the better. And this blog post just reeks of defensiveness.
I mean, it literally opens with, user feedback shows that with AI overviews, people have higher satisfaction with their search results, which is very similar to a thing that Google opened I/O with, which is saying that people are happier with search than ever. And, like, I'm going to need to start seeing citations on this stuff, because in what world? I mean, even if people are enjoying AI overviews, like normal people, which, like, I doubt they are, this is a program that is so, and I think they're doing this in the background, but so it appears so infrequently and so unpredictably that, to be honest, I don't even think if I wanted to, in fact, I know for a fact, if I wanted to rely on AI overviews for my search, I just, like, couldn't really anyway, because, like, I don't know when they're going to appear. You brought up that I/O announcement post. The first example shown in this is a search for how do you clean a fabric sofa, and they get an AI overview. Daniel, I've just searched it and I didn't get an AI overview. So, like, what is even the point of rolling this out wide when, like, it seems very obvious that they are, like, either downplaying when it appears, or, like, you just never know when it's gonna. I had this whole pitch that I don't even think is gonna work, where I wanted to rely on just AI. I had rules set out, right? Just AI. If an AI overview appeared in a search I was doing, that was my only source of information. I could use the citations, but that was it. And I wanted to write about a week of doing this. And I can't really, because, like, I only get an AI overview one out of, like, 30 searches. It's so uncommon that my post would mostly be, if I wrote this, and I might write something about this, but I'm going to have to retool it. It's going to be like, I never know when they're going to appear. There's, like, no rhyme or reason for it, which is not how it was sold at I/O. And I'd argue not even, like, how it was for the first week of AI overviews being live. This is, like, a thing they have clearly been changing in the background.
Yeah. So in addition to this, and I agree with you, like, technically you should be able to rely entirely on AI overviews. Although, to be fair, it's only been a couple of weeks. Google's had a really bad week, so they've probably scaled back the number
yes,
of
exactly.
terms that generate AI overviews. But give it a year, I would assume 99% of searches will have
probably
something.
That's what they want.
So in addition to that, there was this massive leak, about 2,500 documents of Google search API terms, basically the things that Google uses as part of its algorithm to decide what to rank. And Google has always said that a number of factors do not come into play, like domain authority or site authority, right? They've said the fact that you're CNET or The Verge or The Wall Street Journal should not impact the placement of an article itself in search. If something is better, it will outrank you, right? And this was undermined over and over again this year. HouseFresh, as an air purifier website, came out with this big long post about how Dotdash Meredith, which owns a number of well-known sites has basically been gaming the affiliate link system, where they'll post the same content on a bunch of different websites, same images, and it's outranking all of these smaller sites. A lot of what Google has said over the years is like, it's just vibes. Like, just write good stuff and your stuff will float to the top because it's great. And don't worry about it. Like, you're not going to see these major dips unless you do something wrong. And obviously that is not the case. There's a bunch of small publishers, including us, that have seen significant drops in search traffic with no rhyme or reason, right? It's not like anything specific has changed in the strategy. And one of the things that's really interesting out of this is Google appears to be using Chrome data in order to influence rank. So like, Chrome is a product that Google makes. It's a browser. And Google Search is available on all browsers, right? So you're not necessarily going to get a better experience in search if you use Chrome, right? Google has never said, like with the Pixel, you're going to get a better Android experience. It's kind of like that idea that Android and the Pixel are firewalled, and that the Android team does not develop Android in order to make a better Pixel phone, right? It's always been that way. And even now, with the Android team and the Pixel team under one umbrella, Google has said categorically that firewall is still there. But until this week, I don't think I've ever thought that, hey, am I getting a better or different search experience by using Google Chrome on my desktop versus Edge or Arc or whatever? And what it appears to do is that it aggregates anonymized data from Chrome users because you have more actual like data to work with. It's a native app on your Mac or Windows computer. You can see where people are clicking. You can track more easily. You just have more access to the low-level stuff in your operating system. And that's an interest. It's not like, I don't think, hugely revelatory, but it's interesting. I don't know. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, this certainly came at the wrong time for Google, right? Like, I feel like trust between publishers, big and small, and Google is at an all-time low, in part because of all of these frequent changes to its search algorithm, these helpful content updates, as they tend to call them, and stuff like AI overviews, right? Where Google keeps saying that people are going to visit more websites than ever, magically, somehow. As much as this does not reveal, these documents do not reveal exactly how Google's search engine works or how it's listing, like what makes one website appear above the other specifically, I also think that like the fact that it does plenty of the details in here do go against some of the comments they've made previously is a problem for the company, and like I think just erodes trust further and also makes it feel a little hopeless almost. And maybe that's me talking from the writer's perspective, but like I consider the work that I do at Android Police to be good, and not every article that I publish I would say is a success, like from a traffic perspective, right? Like it hurts when you publish something that you're really proud of and people don't read it, and more often than not it comes down to like, well, did search pick it up? Did news pick it up? Did Discover pick it up? And when you're dealing with a company that seems to be talking out of both sides of its mouth, which these documents at least in some ways insinuate, right? Like, as much as there are plenty of publishers who are not innocent in this space, it's still hard. It still sucks.
That's the important part, is we've always known that certain behavior from users will likely influence the placement of a link in Google search, right? Things like how long they spend on that website, right? We get, as publishers, we get access to that data through Google Analytics. So we know bounce rate, we know average viewing duration. We can install tools that allow us to see a heat map of where people go on our articles, right? So for example, if we have a really long guide for something, you've maintained a long guide forever about how to install the Google Play Store on your Kindle tablet. It's a very popular guide. It does hundreds of thousands of sessions a month. It's an evergreen term. And when we say evergreen, it means that tomorrow, if we stop publishing content on Android Police, there will still be articles that generate, quote, passive sessions because those articles are still out there and people are searching for those terms, right? And there are ways to tell if you have a long article, are people getting through the entire thing or are they reaching a point and being like, this is too confusing, we're going to bounce, literally bounce, and go back to Google search to try again. And that would tell us as a publisher, okay, maybe it's at this point in the article that we need to make things clearer or add more context or more images or whatever, right? But Google has never really said all of these things explicitly. They've come out in some way or another through various antitrust lawsuits. And one of those terms called nav boost implies that user click data, the amount of time they spend on the page, the amount of time they spend on like hovering over a link will give Google more data about the authority of that particular click, right? And will potentially improve or lower its ranking. But all of this is happening while AI Overviews is telling the regular Google user that it should be doing the searching for you. So don't even worry about all the other links that are that we're like trying to still manipulate in some way, you know, still focus on good vibes, but like also don't worry about it because we're going to pull the best result anyway. It's just like this whole thing feels for Google itself and for us as publishers, it's like an existential crisis. You know, I go back to using that term incentive structure, like the incentive structure for us as publishers has always been this balance of like, we want to publish stuff that people like and people read, but there's always been this push to get more content to rank well on Google because that's where the passive traffic is. And if you ever just think about the business model of any publisher, right, there are several ways for us to make money. And I know this is super inside baseball, but it might be worth talking about briefly. There's news, which is immediate and is ranked in certain ways, right? Google has Google News. It has Google Carousels, which if you search for a term, it might show you three or four news articles. Or maybe if it's a popular enough term, you'll see like a bunch of boxes. Like during Google I/O, if you search I/O, Google I/O on Google, it would give you like a big box to summarize a whole bunch of articles for I/O from different publishers. Then, you know, there's obviously Google Discover. And then there's aggregators, right? There's Flipboard and Newsbreak and millions of these others, Yahoo News, right? They syndicate content. There's other ways to find this stuff. But generally, if you are searching for a term like how to install the Google Play Store on your Kindle tablet, you type it into Google. And those are called static searches because they don't change from day to day or year to year. They're generally like Google will change the rankings, but those articles will always be relevant because somebody will always be looking to install the Play Store on their Kindle tablet. And as a publisher, we have to do both. We have to try to appeal to the short term, the news and kind of like editorial featurey stuff. And then there's the long term stuff. And as Google's search experience erodes, the ability for publishers to generate that passive traffic, and this is sort of like, a lot of people, whenever there are layoffs at publishers, they'll just be like, well, go to learn to code. I hear people listening to this being like, well, it's your fault for overly relying on Google. Why are you relying on some other company and their opaque algorithms to send you traffic? That's your problem. You now have to fix it. You have to find another way. To which I would respond, fair, like absolutely. But also Google has... Yeah. Been the one reliable source of web traffic for 20 years. At some point, Facebook and Twitter decided to stop sending traffic to websites. There are no other search engines that send any meaningful amount of traffic, right? Bing is a thing.
Actually, this is a fun anecdote since you brought up my Fire tablet guide. I do want to say that that gets a lot of traffic from Bing because Bing is the default search engine on Fire tablets.
Okay, there you go. That's like the weird quirk here.
It's the one. It's literally the one like Android Police article that gets attention from Bing.
I mean, but that also goes to why is Google spending $20 billion a year to put its search engine on iOS devices? For that exact reason. Yeah. Because Microsoft probably spends, I don't know, a very small fraction of that to put its search engine on Amazon tablets.
Yeah.
But that's the reason, is that most people just searching on an iOS device, it's not always clear that you're going to Google. Like, not until you click on the link and it opens Safari and then goes to Google. But like, there's Wolfram Alpha results and there's Siri itself doing stuff. So most people don't care as long as they get the right answer. But yeah, I mean, it feels bad. That's it. It just feels bad. So all that being said, like, I think Google coming out and like acknowledging this leak and trying to fix AI overviews and being forced to be more public about how it ranks things is good for all of us, both users and industry folks. Otherwise, nothing will change, at least if everything changes, it will still be completely opaque. At least now there's a chance that Google will be a bit more open about what's going on. Okay, that's Google search and all that stuff. Very quickly, OpenAI signed a deal with The Atlantic and Vox this week to license its content for ChatGPT.
Yeah.
I think this is interesting, right?
I think it's inevitable, right? Like, I think they have to make these deals or their amount of lawsuits are going to keep growing.
Right.
Which is maybe a cynical read on it. And certainly, you know, I'm particularly curious what comes from this. I know Vox's union is not pleased that they were not in on these discussions. It seems like a really good way for Vox, the media conglomerate, to make more revenue. I don't know if that will trickle down to the writers that are working at these sites. Probably not. You know, again, maybe too cynical, but
well, no, it's not about the revenue. It's not about the revenue trickling down. Without that revenue, talked about it, as traffic erodes in other areas, publishers have no choice but to seek revenue elsewhere, right? You know, the one thing that I didn't talk about in like the kind of content that we publish is affiliate content, mm-hmm. right? And that's an alternative source of revenue built out of a completely different, and this is the term of the day, incentive structure. And as a site that publishes a lot of original reporting, Vox and The Verge and all of its other New York Mag and like all those ones, this feels like it was an inevitable decision because otherwise they would just be scraped, right? Illegally or otherwise. Like, you could put your stuff in robot.txt and prevent OpenAI from scraping your data, but as more people use ChatGPT and Perplexity and even Gemini to search, you want your stuff to be at the top of, you want your stuff to be the result, and you're much more likely to get picked up in that result if your content is being licensed legally. So, very strange. Android. Let's talk about Android for a bit.
Yeah, enough about publishing. Big Android feature drop this week. These are the ones that are for everybody, pushed through like Play Services or app updates, not Pixel feature drops. RCS editing, I think that's handy. This instant hotspot thing.
What does this mean?
Go ahead.
Let's talk about the editing thing, because like,
sure,
that has become sort of table stakes for any messaging app. And you kind of, if you send a message, you want to be able to edit it, but it's also a decision that these companies are making, right? Like, how long do you get to edit something? Should you be allowed to edit something indefinitely? Or should it be sort of like, you can't change the past, you can't manipulate something and like change a conversation, because like, that could have negative consequences. You can basically just manipulate the past if you do that too much. So the choice is, okay, you have 15 minutes to edit something, and it will always say edited next to it as a sort of note. And this is true of WhatsApp, it's true of Telegram, it's true of iMessage. So yeah.
I didn't realize iMessage had a time limit until this conversation, and the AI overview that generated is filling me in. So thank you, Google. I didn't know you could only edit a message in iMessage up to 5 times, which I don't think that limitation is on the RCS side. It's just time.
A sent message up to 5 times within 15 minutes. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if anybody's going to reach that point. Edits of the same message within 15 minutes, but
yeah,
I can sort of see that being like something in a movie where like you sent like a cute message to a crush and then you edit it 5 times and then you reach the limit and you're like, oh crap, I can't edit anymore. And you delete the thing and then you start again. Like, that's fine. That's cute. But 5 times feels enough. Instant hotspot.
Yeah. So instant hotspot lets you connect your tablet or your Chromebook to your phone's hotspot with just a tap, right? I believe it's paired through your Google account, I think. I'm not actually sure how it's paired through.
So it requires the cross-device services setting, which basically uses your Google Play services account and Bluetooth to be aware of other products in the vicinity. So it can do phones, tablets, Chromebooks, and once you've done that, it will no longer require you to like enter a password, it's just like a single click. It's basically like fast pair.
It's but both. It's similar to instant tethering on Chrome OS. Okay. But it obviously extends it beyond Chromebooks. We should also say that, interestingly, it's not coming to Samsung phones or Samsung devices in general, which is a bummer, obviously, because that is, I mean, certainly in the US, the most popular Android OEM. So if you have a Galaxy S device, you won't be able to use Instant Hotspot, which I assume is a play for Samsung to have you buy into its own ecosystem. They want you to go buy a Galaxy Book 4 or whatever their Qualcomm-powered device is called.
I would not be surprised. I'm surprised Google didn't like force Samsung to do this.
Yeah.
In the ways that Google occasionally can force Samsung to do something like that. But I feel like Samsung just wanted to be like, yeah, we're going to use our own thing. We've built the infrastructure. Like, we don't need to participate in your program. And then eventually it will, because it probably knows. I mean, as a dominant player in the Android space, Samsung knows that more Samsung phone owners have Samsung tablets. But there are probably many, many people that have Samsung phones and like an Acer Chromebook or. Actually, most people have Samsung tablets, let's be honest. Like, nobody sells a lot of tablets in the Android space except Samsung. So this makes sense why they didn't participate. It is a little unfortunate, though.
Yeah. Google Home widgets, which is a thing that I guess I didn't realize they didn't have, because in my head, I'm like, yeah, I don't use a lot of widgets. So I'm like, those are probably there, right? Like, widgets to quickly control the devices in your house makes a lot of sense to have on your home screen. And no, this is a thing that they're making now. Daniel, you use a lot more smart home devices than I do, I think. Like, would you use a widget like this? Like, would you keep this on your home screen?
Yeah, I think I would. I have found myself using widgets more often than I thought. And
yeah,
part of the issue with the Google Home app is still that it's pretty bad. So I'll give you an example. I have a Nest thermostat. Whenever I go into the Google Home app and change to, and I like tap on the thermostat button, it always shows me incorrect information. Like, it hasn't updated. So if I want to turn up or down the thermostat, it will still tell me that the thermostat is off, even though I can feel the AC blasting. So my hope is that this widget will solve that problem for me. But I guess this is a good thing. Like, widgets are table stakes for Android apps. I'm surprised it took this long. Also, it's only available for people in the public preview. Like, why? I don't get that part of it, but I'm glad it's here. If you sign up for the public preview, which is super easy, I think everybody should be on it, because there's really no downside to it. And yeah, you can try these out today if you want. And then there's a bunch of Wear OS stuff, which is also, I think, fun. But whenever I see Wear OS stuff, I'm like, do people actually use these features? I can never tell.
I feel like most Wear OS devices are, and it's much like the Apple Watch, are really just like fitness, like very fancy fitness trackers these days. Like, I can see the appeal of unlocking your front door or stuff from your watch, but like at the end of the day, like, I tend to mostly do that stuff on a bigger screen and really only deal with fitness and notifications on a smartwatch, because that's how, you know, when a screen is that small, that's kind of where it feels most comfortable.
And then there's more digital car key support, which is great. It's coming to mini cars today and select Mercedes-Benz and Polestars soon. So not a huge number of cars, let's be honest. But I don't know. I mean, every time Google rolls something out, it's like, now these five people can use this feature. I'm like, fantastic.
Well, that's the most frustrating thing. I want to give Google credit, because I think Android feature drops make Android as a platform much more exciting than iOS, for example, where you are, you know, with a couple of exceptions, really waiting for annual drops, right? Mm-hmm. You are waiting for the big iOS drop in September to get 1,000 new features. Not really, but, you know, whatever, a bunch of new features. And then you might get one in November, right? Like, that's late. It's not ready for September, so it's arriving late. It's not even like a surprise gift. And then that's it. And you wait for another year. And that can make one day in September really exciting, but I've always appreciated that Google is like, listen, like, these are not the...
It does make one day in September really exciting, and then
right,
the rest of it is like, although Apple does announce things at WWDC and then roll them out like 6 months later, that's very common these days.
Yeah, I guess it makes 2 days. It'll make in 10 days we'll be very excited, or, you know, other people will be very excited. I'll be curious. And then in September, people will be excited to try it. I like that Google and the Android team roll this stuff out a lot faster and like have these big pushes where they're like, we've got like 8 new features that are, it's a grab bag of features that you can check out. The problem with it comes, as you said, that like they slow roll stuff out so much that like some of the stuff, you know, you might not get that new Google Home widget for 2 months, because it, maybe that's a bad example because it's in preview or whatever, but like you might not get RCS edits for 2 weeks, right? Because it's a server-side update or something. Like, you would just have to wait for it, which I think does take away from some of the excitement.
Yeah, exactly. But then when it shows up randomly, you're like, oh, that's fun.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
I forgot about this. It's like finding $20 in your jacket.
If you work at Android Police, it's, did we cover this? We did. We covered it 2 months ago.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Just, we covered just it as a leak, yeah. And then the announcement, and then the rollout, which is like three separate things.
There we go.
Okay, let's talk about this PS5 announcement yesterday. Astrobot, the sequel to Astro's Playroom, which came for free on every PS5, and was actually a really good game. I played it like 2 years after I got the PS5. It's getting an official sequel that you'll have to pay for, but it looks really good.
I would say that both this state of play and like Sony's output as a whole on the PlayStation 5 is like concerning to me. I know there are a lot of memes about how the PS5 doesn't have games. I'm not even talking about that. I just think that like, and this is true of AAA gaming in general, but like it seems very stuck in an era that I'm not sure people, you know, want to continue caring about. A full like third of this state of play presentation yesterday was showing off this like Overwatch knockoff that is also a Guardians of the Galaxy knockoff.
Was it called like Marvel something?
Not even that.
Oh, the Concord.
It's own. Yeah, Concord.
Yeah, yeah.
The Marvel Rivals thing is also in they had two different Overwatch clones that had Marvel vibes in an era where, maybe excitement about Deadpool 3 aside, Marvel is kind of not the hot thing right now, right? It's like very evident of when you put a game into development and it takes 7 years to come out that like trends have changed. Like, no one is really looking for, I mean, Marvel Rivals is like designed purely because Overwatch is not in China anymore, but Concord is like the bigger example of like, you've poured all this time and money into something that like you can just feel like it's not going to go anywhere, like so many of these other Overwatch clones haven't. And it just cycles through like all these titles that I'm not sure who they're for. And then we get to this like colorful platformer near the end of the show starring Astrobot, and it looks great. They're saying over 80 levels. It has die and retry levels that are like actual platforming challenges. That sounds great. It both ties into like the PlayStation brand. Like they're not shying away from how like that Astro's Playroom game was like very deep into like the lore of, not the lore, but the world of PlayStation. Like that is still the thing here.
Yeah. Is there a lore? Is there a PlayStation lore? I don't know. I also thought
there
that.
Is now, but did you watch the Astrobot trailer? There's like flying PS5s or whatever.
I know.
Think
there I loved
is.
It.
I think my PS5 is like a little alien.
I know. I love it. But I'm also like, but is that a good thing? Do we really want, like, at some point there's going to be like a PlayStation movie starring like Mark Wahlberg? Oh my God. And
it, like, no, the answer is like, it's not good, but like, it's compared to everything else to like see Sony be like, also we have, it's like a video game. You just like play it and you have a good time. That's all I'm really looking for at this point is like you play a video game and have a good time. And it's not like, oh, like you're going to watch like a knockoff Guardians of the Galaxy movie and then just play like knockoff Overwatch. Like it was just very jarring to like get shifted into this alternate world Sony that reminds me of what they were doing in the PlayStation 1 and the PlayStation 2 in the midst of like God of War Ragnarok is coming to like Steam. And I'm not even, that's not even a bad game. It's just like, that's like all Sony puts up now is like cinematic action games. And then also like one platformer every 5 years. And I'm not even saying it has to be a platformer. It's just nice to see a like game that I'm going to sit down and play. Like within 5 minutes of booting it up, I will be exploring levels and doing things as opposed to watching like a 90-minute cutscene and then playing Overwatch.
Yeah. I mean, I did that with Hi-Fi Rush and then...
That's a great example, to be honest. They, like they colorful... They did.
And they closed the entire studio. So it's kind of sad. I mean, I see why, right? Like Destiny 2 is still such a huge game after all these years, and Sony now owns Bungie and it has the data to prove out that live service games are working. So why not own a couple of those like, IP?
Live service games from a decade ago, you know, like everyone is still, God, I was talking to my best friend about this last week. We were talking about his nephew who is, I believe, 12. And most of what he plays at this point is like Fortnite and Minecraft. And I was like, Minecraft's older than him. Does he know that? Like Minecraft like came out before, like no matter how you are, whether you're talking about like the earliest builds or even just like 1.0, like Minecraft is older than him. That was a game like, that was out when we were in high school and your like 12-year-old nephew is still obsessed with it. Like it that's one of like six games that are like that where you're like, oh, Fortnite is like 7 years old now, right? Like it's not a new game anymore, but it's played like it's a new game. And that's all of these like attempts at live service titles are, I mean, even single player games are like struggling in the face of like a lot of people being like, I'll just play the thing I've been playing for 5 years, 10 years. I'll just keep doing that. Why would I change to something new?
I do that. I mean, my default is to open like Diablo 3 still, even though I don't like I own Diablo 4 and I still play Diablo 3 more than I do Diablo 4. On my phone, I play Hold Down. Literally, the only mobile game I play is Hold Down, and I don't know why I could play anything else, but Hold Down is like a perfect game. And it's true. Like you like what you like. I mean, my wife still plays Threes. It's been 13 years since Threes came out and she still plays it every day.
No, it can't be 13 years, right? That's wrong.
Sorry.
Right?
No, I'm wrong. It's been 10 years. I messed up the math.
That
I
was, still doesn't make me feel very good, but
it came out in 2014.
All right.
So yeah,
I was going to say, I think I was in college and I was, but oh, okay. I still didn't like that.
Also, just another absolutely perfect mobile game. Like, so brilliant.
Yeah.
Hasn't been many like that since. Anyway, we're going to end it there. I think we are exhausted. as you can probably tell.
We're tired.
We're tired. But I want to thank everybody for sending in their homework over the last few weeks. It's been really fun just like getting to know you. I got a couple of emails last week that were really nice, and I just appreciate the people that send in emails saying how much they enjoy the show, because that's why we do it, right? We don't have ads in the show. This is not like a big business thing for us. This is just a fun weekly show.
Essentially a hobby.
Yeah, it's a hobby that we just keep doing because it's the best. So thank you everybody for listening. I do have a bit of homework for you this week. I would love to know what mobile games you're all playing, because there are so many. Netflix just released a bunch of new mobile games this week. Apple Arcade is still releasing games somehow. There's a new game from Supercell. What's it called? It just came out. Squad Busters, apparently, which is really, really addictive. It's like a MOBA, I think.
Oh, I didn't even know this. That's
cool. I mean, it's Supercell, right? So like the games are very similar to each other. But this is like Clash of Clans, Brawl Stars, like this company, they just make really good addictive mobile games. I'd love to know if anybody's actually playing this. So yeah, tell me what you're playing. podcast@androidplace.com. We love hearing from you. And that's it. Will, thank you so much. And I hope you have
Daniel.
Great weekend.
I hope you do too.
We're just going to like fucking collapse now and take a nap. Okay.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. All right. Bye.
Bye.